Welcome to another edition of the Exponential Podcast. I'm Todd Wilson, Director of Exponential. We're thrilled you're taking advantage of this free resource that was recorded at the Exponential Conference. It's part of a library of hundreds of hours of free training. In our mission to equip church planning leaders, we seek to distribute as many free resources as possible. Visit exponential.org to learn more and to check out the programming for the upcoming Exponential Conference.
So this whole concept, you know, we called the breakout Engaging God's Mission Where You Live, Work, and Play. For me, that comes from a book. It's a sociological book that was written in 1989 called The Great Good Place. I don't know if any of you have ever heard. I don't know that I would, like, highly recommend. Let me just tell you what the book's about. We won't have time for all of this. Sorry. Okay, there. The Great Good Place. So it was written in 1989 by a sociologist named Ray Oldenburg. And here's the premise of the book. The book is really about what Oldenburg calls third places. And we're going to come back to this. But a third place is a place of common ground or neutrality where people would used to go to be known and known other people. It's a place where people would go to hang out. Okay? Well, the book is primarily about third places. It's really about the demise of third places. To get there, Oldenburg talks about how our neighborhoods and our communities have become placeless places. In other words, certain forces in American culture have brought our communities really to lose their relational vitality. So Oldenburg in the book says it's really the result of three things. Number one is suburban sprawl. And you guys know what that, you know, it's just people in the city moving out to the suburbs. Number two is what he calls the rise of the automobile culture. So in other words, people get in their cars, typically by themselves, and we drive out of our neighborhoods to go to work, to go to school, to get a haircut, to go shopping, to go to church. So we are displaced from place as we drive out of our neighborhoods, the places where we ought to be doing life. We actually end up doing life elsewhere. And then the third force is the rise of what he calls the entertainment, really home entertainment industry. So in 1989, it was pretty much just television. Now we have all kinds of things, right? Well, all that I find fascinating. I just think I think we need to re-engage or recapture what I would call a theology of place. So a book like Oldenburg's book, I just find fascinating. And there's a lot of really good writing on this topic. But here's one little line out of his book that I remember the first time I read this about 10 years ago. I thought that would be a really helpful way to frame what it looks like to live out missionality, or what it would look like to live out a missionary lifestyle. Does that make sense? So it's just a really helpful way. Well, here's the phrase. In the book, Oldenburg talks about our first, second, and third places. So from a sociological perspective, for Oldenburg, first place is where you live, second place is where you work, and third place are these places of neutrality where people would go to hang out. Well, again, when I first read that, I thought, wow, I think that's a really helpful way for us as missionally minded people to think about framing, just in a real practical sense, what it would look like to live out a missionary lifestyle. So that's what I want us to talk about for a few minutes here this afternoon, is what does it look like when we think about our first, second, and third places, what does that look like to engage in God's mission in those places? Okay? So just to get us there a little bit, so I told you the name of the book is The Great Good Place, and here's the subtitle. I always have to read it because it's so long I can never remember everything that's in the subtitle. So it's called The Great Good Place, and the subtitle is Cafes, Coffee Shops, Community Centers, Beauty Parlors, General Stores, Bars, Hangouts, and How They Get You Through the Day. So really, when it comes to, I think it's a fabulous book. It's very helpful. But the thing I want us to focus on is that little phrase that he coined when he talked about our first, second, and third places. So let's talk about first places first. When it comes to first place, like I said, from Oldenburg's perspective, it's where we live. Well, for me, that involves two things. It involves the art of neighboring. I mean, we need to re-neighbor our neighborhoods. And then secondly, it involves what I call biblical hospitality. So we don't really have time to dig into the neighborhood thing. I mean, really, the book, Next Door as It Is in Heaven, the whole book we wrote is about engaging our neighborhoods. But let me just share with you two quick little things. First off, it's really difficult for us to love our neighbors, as Jesus says in Matthew 22, when we don't know our neighbors' names. So most of the time in the training we do, and we did this in the pre-con very quickly yesterday, is there's this little grid that we'll use a lot of times for training, but we usually need to have more time to do this. But let me just show you. So are any of you familiar with the book by Dave Runyon called The Art of Neighboring? Okay, I see a few hands. Well, this grid's on the cover of the book. And we use this all the time. I mean, I'll have copies of this printed out and hand them out to everybody. And here's how the little exercise would go if we had time to do this. I'd say, okay, I want you to draw a little box in that middle, or a little house in that middle box, and that represents your house. And then we'll say, okay, now I want you to take a couple of minutes, and I want you to put the names of every person that lives in the house around you in those other eight boxes. Now, typically, there's like crickets when I first say that. And especially with pastors, it's like, oh, no, you know. So at Runyon's Church, they call this the grid of shame. So it's not to shame you, but it is, I mean, it's challenging, right? So, I mean, again, we don't really have time to do this. And a lot of times we'll joke and we'll say things like, you can't put like the bald fat guy that walks the dog or the woman that smokes on her deck or, you know, they have to be names, real names. But let me just ask, I mean, again, that you don't really have time to do this, but do you think, could anyone in the room name all eight people around that grid? Okay. Then you get a book. Okay. So, okay, I'll get you one too. So, but it is challenging, isn't it? I mean, because I'm telling you, we do this, we've done it hundreds and hundreds of times. And typically, senior leaders in churches, they're the worst at this. I mean, there's times really we'll say, anyone have all eight? And they'll be like, no hands. And we'll go, seven? Six? We'll get to five. And then I'll say, we'll just stop there. And people will go, phew. You know, it's like, good, I'm glad you stopped there. Well, the point is, part of our first place is the art of neighboring. It's re-neighboring our neighborhoods. I mean, God has sent you where you live for a purpose. And we need people, we need to give practical kind of guides of what does it look like? Because again, too often, like Oldenburg talked about, we get in our cars and we leave our neighborhoods. I mean, our neighborhood is not a collection of relationships. It's just a place where we, you know, sleep at night and then we do life somewhere else. And I don't think that's right. I mean, I think we need to recapture that theology of place. Now, just one other real practical piece on the neighboring is if you're not familiar with this website, boy, make a note of it. Just go to nextdoor.com. Extremely helpful. And again, some of you have already done this, but go to nextdoor.com, read about it, sign up for it. You get notifications. It's an app you can have on your phone and your computer that just helps people connect relationally in the neighborhood. I mean, just today, I've probably gotten 8 or 9 notifications. One, someone's looking for someone to help roof their house, build a deck, lost a cat. You know, it's just lots of, it just gives you an opportunity to make some of those connections, okay? So it's just not, we don't have time to talk anymore about neighboring, but I want you to see first place, I think it has to start in our neighborhoods, okay? And who better than us? I mean, we know we've been created as social relational beings, to be in a relationship with God, but also to be in relationships with each other. And what better place to do that than in our neighborhoods, right? So then I said first place. The second part of first place is what I would call biblical hospitality. I just think this is an enormous, enormous theme in Scripture that I think we underestimate or frankly, we just ignore. It's a fabulous, very powerful, strong theme throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament. Now, in both Missional Quest, and then also in this new book, Next Door as It Is in Heaven, there's one chapter I just wrote on hospitality just to kind of help recapture the power of real, true biblical hospitality. And I always use the adjective biblical to differentiate biblical hospitality from what most people think of when they hear the word hospitality. I mean, I'm afraid most of the time we think of entertaining. And I remember a long time ago someone saying the difference between entertaining and hospitality is that entertaining puts the emphasis on you as the host, where hospitality puts the emphasis on your guest. Now, I think that's helpful, but that's not biblical hospitality. But it's helpful because I think it's true, isn't it? I mean, when we entertain, what do? Before people come over to our house? Of course, we clean, right? Now, I'm not saying have a dirty house, but we have to ask, why do we do that? I think a lot of times we do it because we're concerned of the reflection our home will have on us. Well, when that's the case, that's entertaining. That's not hospitality. But Scripture just gives multiple really cool nuances on hospitality throughout Scripture. Let me just share with you a couple of them. In the Old Testament, hospitality mainly has to do with extending it to what I would call, well, Tim Keller calls the quartet of the vulnerable. It's the orphan, the widow, the poor, and the foreigner, or the alien. So there's just Scripture after Scripture in the Old Testament that speaks to the theme of hospitality, where we extend that to those four different people groups. So I think is a very powerful kind of picture. when a foreigner resides among you, this is Leviticus 19. I mean, this is part of the laws describing holiness. When a foreigner resides among you in your land, do not mistreat them. The stranger residing among you must be treated as your native born. Love them as yourself. That little Hebrew word actually means they're just like you. So you need to love them because they're just like you. Oh, no, I might be losing this. For you are foreigners in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. In the New Testament, and again, so that's the major theme in the Old Testament. But in the New Testament, the best place to start to really understand biblical hospitality is the Greek word. So it's actually a combination of two words. It's a word for love, and it's a word for stranger. So think about that. In the New Testament, every single time you see the word hospitality, it literally means love of stranger. Now that doesn't sound like entertaining, does it? Love of stranger. So Matthew 25, you guys are familiar with this. Powerful passage, I think. The parable of the sheep and the goats. This is one of my favorite. I mean, Jesus just pushes the theme of hospitality to another level here. And this is probably a passage that I read dozens and dozens of time. And I missed something, I think, in the very last portion of this passage. So listen, Jesus says, when you give a dinner or a banquet, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or your rich neighbors. That's always funny to me. Don't invite your rich neighbors. Okay. Why? Lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Because when we entertain, what happens at the end of the evening when people are getting ready to walk out the door? A lot of times, what do they say? Yeah, next time, right? Next time, our place. I mean, we'll be repaid. But he goes on to say, but when you give a feast, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Isn't that cool? Because they cannot repay you. So part of biblical hospitality is not only loving the stranger, but it's extending it to those that cannot reciprocate. Now, once again, that doesn't sound like entertaining, does it? I mean, we're extending it to those that they're not in a position to pay you back or to reciprocate. So again, lots of other passages. Romans 12. I love this. Rejoice in hope, be patient in suffering, persevere in prayer, contribute to the needs of the saints, extend hospitality. John Stott's commentary on this passage, he says a way better word than extend hospitality is pursue. He says Paul is actually saying we need to pursue hospitality. I mean, we need to look for time and opportunities to extend it to others, to give it to others. We need to pursue that. Hebrews 13, this one always freaked me out when I was little, I think. You know, hospitality to or to angels, maybe, and you don't know it. 1 Timothy 3:2, I think it's interesting that, you know, a lot of tribes kind of use this as the kind of the definition or the markers of a leader. And we like to talk about a lot of those markers, but rarely will we talk about hospitality. I mean, that a leader ought to be radically hospitable. I mean, do we hold each other to that? I mean, not really. 1 Peter 4:9. So in a strict sense, I like to say hospitality, it is about loving the stranger, but in a strict sense, it's about inviting people into a relationship. It's about inviting, not only inviting people into relationship with us, but it's about inviting people into our network of relationships. So I like to say biblical hospitality, it is about creating physical environments to invite people into, but it's really about opening our lives to people. It's really about giving a voice to those that rarely have a voice. I mean, you get that. And you see what a powerful, I mean, what if we, as followers of Jesus, if we were known as being people of radical hospitality from a biblical perspective? It's very transformative, I believe. So I wish we had time. I mean, so much there on hospitality. But here's the part, just get real practical for a few minutes, is why don't we do this? I mean, if it's a strong biblical theme in Scripture, why aren't we radically hospitable people? Well, I think there's multiple reasons, but let me share with you two that I think are probably the biggest. The first one is what I call lack of a margin. So I like to say it like this. You can't not add hospitality to an already overburdened life. So I don't know if you're familiar with the phrase or the theme of margin, but this comes from a book written by a Christian psychiatrist about 20 years ago. I'll bet several of you know this book probably, right? Okay. I read this book probably 20 years ago, and really, no exaggeration, every single week I'm reminded of this. I just think it's super helpful. So here's what Swinson does. Here's what he means by margin. Is he says that if you opened any book, you would never see the ink on the page or the words on the page. You would never see them go all the way to the top of the page, the bottom of the page, and left and right. Right? I mean, you'd hate the publisher. I mean, it'd be hard to read if it was like that. But he says instead, every single book you ever open, there's this thing that goes around every single page called a margin. Well, he uses that as a metaphor to say that should be a picture of our lives, that our lives have to have margin in them. And he talks about all kinds of margin, financial margin, time margin, relational margin. Well, I like to say relationships happen in the margins. So the point is, you can't be spontaneous relationally. You can't allow God to interrupt you when there's no margin in your life. And you know you have no margin when you're late, you know, 15 minutes to one thing and it puts you 30 minutes late to the next thing. And you know what I mean? I mean, you know what that's like. And we in this room, we're the worst at this, aren't we? I mean, we want to be busy. But to be radically hospitable, you can't be busy all the time. We have to create margin in our lives. So here's just a couple little quotes from the book I like. He says, without margin, we're incapable of relational spontaneity in our neighborhood. So in other words, you get home on Wednesday night and, you know, you got another meeting to go to and Bob's taking his trash out and you want to go over and say hi to Bob, but you think, well, man, I'd really like to go, but I know Bob's a talker, so I don't really have time. So there's no margin, right? I mean, you're laughing because you can relate to that, right? Without margin, we're uninterested in opportunities to serve our neighbors. I mean, when you live a crazy, chaotic life, you're not even interested in it. It's like, no, please don't, you know, don't come over and say hi or knock on our door. Without margin, we're unable to even think about planning time to spend with others. I mean, is this convicting? It is to me. So then Swinson says, margin creates buffers. It gives us room to breathe, freedom to act, time to adapt. Only then will we be able to truly nourish our relationships. Only then will we be available, and I like this, interruptible for the purposes of God. So how do we do that? I mean, how do we create margin? This is super simple stuff, but I have to work on this a lot. But in the book, well, yeah, that's right. Part of it is you have to say no. That's part of the first. So there's three A's. I've just tried to kind of organize my thoughts. So in the chapter on hospitality in this new book, I just fleshed this out a little bit more. But kind of three A's that help me. One is to do a margin audit. So in fact, to just actually look at your calendar, you know, your daily, your weekly calendar, and see, is there margin in your daily life where you could be interruptible by God? And to do that, sometimes you have to say no. Not sometimes. We probably have to say no a lot. I love Anne Lamott has a little phrase. She says, no is a complete sentence. That's good, isn't it? No is a complete sentence. In fact, it's a mathematical necessity, right? I mean, some days there might be like 12 really good, important things you need to do, but you only have time to do 7. Well, that means you need to say no to 5 of them, right? It's a mathematical necessity. So we have to get ruthless about this. I mean, and we need to help each other. That's the last A, accountability. We need someone in our lives. For me, it's my spouse and my wife, but we have to hold each other accountable. One of the things we do, and we miss some Sunday nights, but most Sunday nights, my wife and I sit down and we look at our calendar for the week. And we see exactly what is she doing, what am I doing. You know, we kind of like map it so she kind of knows where I am and vice versa. But mainly it's looking at our schedule and saying, well, you know, is there a night where we can have people over? Is there a night we can just make extra food and invite the kids or whatever it is? So you need accountability, but also we need to do a margin audit. And I would say a margin audit, we need to do that personally, but we probably need to do it in the life of our local churches as well. You know, are we keeping church people so busy with church stuff that there's no margin for them to really incarnate into their local neighborhood, all right? And then the second A, alignment, here's what I mean by that, is that a lot of times when people hear about all this missional stuff, sometimes it can be overwhelming. It's like, oh, crap, I got to do, you know? So I like to say, no, think of alignment, not addition. Think of alignment, not addition. So we want to try to align the rhythms of our lives with the rhythms of the lives of others. Does that make sense? So most of us eat 21 meals a week. Some of us eat more than that. But 21 meals a week, well, what would it look like to give 3 or 4 of those meals a week to someone? I mean, to share it with someone. And I like to say, don't too narrowly define sharing a meal. It might mean coffee. It might mean taking someone out to lunch at a restaurant. I do think the best thing is to have a full-blown meal in your home with people, but it doesn't have to always be that, okay? So alignment is just thinking. Where I live in Kansas City, Sunday afternoon Chiefs football is a huge thing in our house. I have a 21-year-old son that's just a football nut. So we're going to watch the Chiefs game anyway. So what does it look like to invite people to come and watch the game with us? So it's just alignment. Simple stuff, but it's freeing. You don't have to add a bunch of stuff. Does that make sense? Okay, so the first reason we don't do it, I think, is lack of margin. The second reason I don't think we do it is fear. So I told you the Greek word philoxenia, love of stranger, most Christians don't know that word, but they do know another word, xenophobia, right? So instead of love of stranger, the word we're all familiar with is fear of stranger. Now, I think there's probably like a clinical expression of really being afraid of strangers, and I get that, but most of the time, especially in evangelical circles, I think we've kind of like cultivated this unbiblical, crazy fear of strangers, and the stranger danger. And again, please don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying, we have to be wise about all of this, but I do think, and I want to read you a quote from Deb Hirsch, where she talks about how our view of the family and our desire for safety and security around our families has actually become disastrous for our ability to be radically hospitable. So a lot of times when I'll read this, I'll say, look, this may step on some toes, and it still steps on my toes, some today, but there was a day this would have crushed my toes. It would have crushed my feet. But it's a little book that Alan and Deb wrote several years ago called Untamed. And in the book, Alan or Deb writes a chapter called Refocusing on the Family. So it's a little play on words there, Refocusing on the Family. And this quote comes from that. So it's two slides. I hate to read all this to you, but she articulates this so well. I just can't articulate it this well. But you'll see what I mean. She really challenges us as it relates to our view of the family and how that gets in the way of being radically hospitable. So here's what she writes in the chat, in that book. She says, this is our space, talking about our homes, and those we may invite into that space are carefully chosen based on whether they will upset the delicate status quo, inconvenience us, or pose a threat to our perceived safety. In other words, visitors, especially strange ones, stress us out. And while this is in some sense culturally understandable, the negative result in terms of our spirituality is that the family has effectively become a pernicious idol. That's really strong. I mean, isn't it? Pernicious means wicked. So she says, culture has once again trumped our social responsibility in such a situation. She calls it missional hospitality, is seen as a threat, not as an opportunity to extend the kingdom. So an idol is born. It's not hard to see how this is absolutely disastrous from a missional perspective. I love these last two lines. Our families and our homes should be places where people can experience a foretaste of heaven, where the church is rightly viewed as a community of the redeemed from all walks of life. But instead, our fears restrict us from letting go of the control and safety we've spent years cultivating. I mean, boom, right? Now, is that convicting? It should be. And again, it might be kind of hard, but I think she's right. And again, it doesn't mean we don't have boundaries and barriers. And I like to say mission is best done as a communal activity, that we need to engage in mission communally. And this is part of the reason, is that we need to discern together about where we're going and how we do things. So I just want to say that we need to do this with wisdom. But for most people, it's just fear just keeps them from opening their homes. So let me share with you one quick little story, just something that we did to try to kind of break the bonds of this in our lives, because I can relate to this. And I'll usually say, look, this is descriptive, not prescriptive. So I'm just saying this is what we did. I'm not saying this is what you should do. But if my wife was here, she'd say, no, I'm pretty sure this is what you should do too. So we've been in Kansas City now for 11 years, and one of the reasons we bought the house that we bought is that it had an extra bedroom. Now, I'm embarrassed to tell you the reason is because I thought I needed a home office. So this perfectly good bedroom, we converted to an office. And one night, my oldest son and my wife and I were sitting in the living room all on our laptops. And I noticed my wife looked up from her laptop, and she looked over at my son, and she looked over at me, and I knew we were in trouble. And she said, hey, I got a question for you too. She said, when was the last time one of you guys went into the office? And then I really knew we were in trouble. And I said, well, I think like a week ago I went in there to get a pen or paperclip or something. And she said, well, this is stupid. I mean, she says we have a perfectly good bedroom that we can't use. So that bedroom we converted to an office, we converted back to a bedroom just to put ourselves in a better position to have people in our homes, in our home. And we've always been very hospitable people. My wife loves to cook. She's like this crazy extrovert. I am not. She's never met a stranger. And, you know, she likes to make extra food, invite people over. But still, if we're really honest about it, to go back to Deb's quote, it was still kind of on our watch. You know what I mean? People were still pretty carefully chosen if they were going to upset the delicate status quo. So to push the envelope a little bit further, my wife was convinced that we need to become foster parents. So we went through the foster training several years ago. And now I would say, I mean, we've really lost count, but somewhere north of 70 kiddos have come through our home in the last several years. And one of those we adopted a couple years ago. Here, I know I'll get some ooze from this, so I got to show. I think I've got it there. That's Chloe. So, and I like to joke, when we adopted Chloe, she was 4, which is a really big deal because I'm old. And seriously, like every month, I'll like do the math of like how old will I be when she graduates from high school? And I just hope to still be alive, okay? So I know it's a low bar, but that's what I'm shooting for. So... But here's, and when we have time, we like to talk a lot about the whole foster care story because of 3 things. One, I would say it's a fabulous way to influence the lives of children. And some of you do foster care, and you know that. Secondly, though, it's a beautiful way to influence the lives of parents, which in 90% of the cases is a single mom. But then thirdly, and this is relates to biblical hospitality, it's the single best thing we've ever done for our other kids. I mean, really, bar none. I mean, they've been involved in lots of different church stuff, and I'm not diminishing that, but it's the single best thing we've ever done for our 2 boys. For them to see where these kids come from and to understand their story and the connection that we continue to have with them, and hopefully for them to see us loving on these kids that come through our home, it's changed our kids. And that's the thing about real biblical hospitality is just when you think it's for the benefit of the other, and it is, but you discover you're the real beneficiary. I mean, that's not entertaining. That's true biblical hospitality. So a little phrase to kind of sum that up. This comes from a book called Radical Hospitality. I love this. When you think of fear, they said the real question isn't how dangerous is the stranger. The real question is how dangerous will I become if I'm not more open? And see, and again, you guys all know this, but what fear does is fear actually makes our lives smaller. But when we become radically hospitable, it actually opens our lives up and our lives get larger. I think that's kingdom living, is it not? Okay, so first place is where we live. And for me, it involves those 2 components. It involves our neighborhood, and that involves a ton of stuff, really good, and then involves biblical hospitality. Second place, and we'll just do 1 slide here because I want to spend the rest of our time on third places. Second place has to do with our vocation. Here's what the primary thing about this is to say that we need to help people in our congregations understand that their vocation, which, you know, that word, that vocation literally means calling, what God has called them to do, their vocation is not primarily about economic exchange. It's not about climbing the corporate ladder. It's not about achieving the American dream, but it's helping them see how does their calling fit into the mission of God. So another one of those paradigm shifts that I always like to talk about, but we didn't have time to talk about here, is what I call participation in the Missio Dei. So in other words, it's not about our mission. It's about God's mission. So I like to say God's church doesn't really have a mission. Rather, God's mission has a church. See, the church is an instrument created by God to be sent into the world to participate in what God's already doing. Well, we need to help people in our churches understand that it's of the devil to talk about sacred and secular vocations. God reigns over all. It's all sacred. But see, I mean, and you guys have had conversations like this where people say, oh man, I'd love to be in full-time ministry. I mean, I don't care what they do, they're in full-time ministry. So we need to help them see that. We need to help them see that how their vocation contributes to and participates in the mission of God. I like to say it like this sometimes, that too many people leave their houses on Monday morning and somehow think they leave God behind. So we need to help them see, regardless of what it is that God's called them to do, that they're entering into the mission of God, and help them see, discover what God's doing, and then discern how does he want me to participate in what he's doing. I mean, that's a huge deal, isn't it? Well, that's all about second place. It's vocation. So, sorry, I wish we had more time, because I want to spend the most, and then let's talk about all of this. is third place. So when it comes to third places, again, the subtitle kind of describes what Oldenburg's talking about in his book, The Great Good Place. Now, here's the thing. Oldenburg, again, he's a sociologist. I don't know if he's a believer or not. But Oldenburg, as a sociologist, has a very defined box or description of a third place. In fact, in his book, he gives 8 characteristics that really clearly articulate or define for him what a third place is, okay? Well, I think it's helpful, but I think we need to kind of crack open our imagination. So I talk about typical third places and atypical third places. But so I want for you to understand a typical third place, let me show you these 8 characteristics. We won't read all of these, but you'll get a sense for what I mean here. So here's the first 4. So he says, first off, they're neutral ground. So in other words, people are free to come and go as they please, okay? There's not really one person that's necessarily the host, unless it's like the bartender or, you know, somebody that's working there. So it's just, it's common ground or neutral ground. Number 2, it acts as a leveler. So that's really good. So regardless of your social location, when you go into a third place, everyone's on the same level playing field, okay? Does that make sense? Number 3, conversation is the main activity. So it's not a physical activity. In a perfect third place, from Oldenburg's perspective, the number 1 activity is conversation. People are just having fun talking to each other. And then the 4th one is accessible and accommodating. So it's easy to get to. You don't have to go up on the 24th floor. Or, you know, it's very accessible. In most cases, it's walkable, that people go to these typical traditional third places from their home. Okay. The next 4, they're regulars. That's kind of a no-brainer. The next one, low profile. In other words, they're not fancy. Sometimes we describe them as hole in the walls, right? Mood is playful. Again, people are having a good time. They enjoy being there. And then lastly, it's a home away from home. So when you think of those characteristics, and if you're as old as I am, and on television, I mean, what was the quintessential third place? Cheers. Yeah, of course, it was Cheers, right? And what's kind of fun, if we had time, is to go back to those 8 characteristics, and every one of them is, you know, it's depicted in Cheers. The best example probably is acts as a leveler. I mean, you have the mailman and a psychiatrist sitting at the bar having a beer together. It just acts as a leveler. But it's fascinating to me when you go back and look at, especially sitcoms, dramas not so much, but sitcoms over the years, every one of them had a third place. So, I mean, just look at some of these. Again, some of you are going, what's that top left picture? So it was Floyd's Barbershop in Mayberry. It was Arnold's in Happy Days. In the middle, Central Perk, Friends. Of course, you got Monk's Cafe. Over here, it's How I Met Your Mother. I think it was called McLaren's Pub, right? And then I like to joke and say, look, even SpongeBob had the Krusty Krab. I just like that picture. I don't know why. I like that. So here's the point. From Oldenburg's perspective, there are typical third places. So again, they're those third places that he describes in the subtitle. Okay, it's a coffee shop, the cafe, pub, general store, beauty parlor, barber shops. Okay, again, I think that's really helpful. But I think we need to, as missionally minded people, we need to crack open our imagination and to think of atypical third places. So let me just give you some examples of those: the library, a gym, laundromat, farmer's market, community garden, a park, grocery store, shopping mall. So it's a place where people wouldn't necessarily go to hang out, but it's a place where you frequent so often that if you're intentional, it's an opportunity to build relationships with people. Does that make sense? So I'll give you for an example. For me, there's a local gym that I like to go to play racquetball. And only because I'm intentional, I know everybody that works there, everybody that goes there the same time of the day that I do. And I just have to be intentional. And sometimes I need prompting. I was telling a story just the other day. I'm a huge music fan. I love listening to music. But the other day, there was a guy that I'd seen a couple of times. He was an older guy that would come to the gym. And one day, and the Lord doesn't talk to me very often, but one day at the gym just a couple of weeks ago, I just felt like the Lord said, take your earbuds out. And I remember thinking, I really like this song. And he said, take your earbuds out. And I saw this guy, now I know his name's Scott, and I take my earbuds out, and I set my iPhone down, and I mean, just as soon as I did, Scott just made a beeline straight to me. And I never talked to him before, but he had something he wanted to talk about. And one of the things he wanted to talk about is he had seen Chloe with me, and it was kind of like, what's that about? So, you know, it's like, so you know, is she yours? Or, you know, because it's pretty obvious she's not. I mean, you know what I mean. But here's what's really crazy is last week, Scott, and I mean, Scott's just as lost as a, whatever, a goose. But he came up to me and he said, hey, man, he said, I just found out I have a 34-year-old daughter that lives in Michigan. I was like, I said, what's that about? And we just laughed about it. But it was just crazy. It's like, he was telling me how he just found out. I mean, how does that happen, right? 34 years old and you just now found out? So all that to say, I don't go to the gym to hang out. But if it's you're intentional, and my wife is great about this. I mean, her atypical third place is kind of embarrassing, but it's our local Target. She's so intentional about it. She's built relationships at Target with people that work there. Price Chopper is a grocery store that's just about 2 blocks from our house. Same thing. I try not to go to the grocery store with her very often, but kind of the funniest story is one day I was walking through the front door of Price Chopper, and the produce department was just right off to the side. And as soon as we walked through the door, the produce guy, who's also named, his name happens to be Brad, he yells out, "Hey, Michelle!" And I look at my wife and I said, "Why does the produce guy know your name?" And I knew why, of course. But because she's so intentional in going to those places, so those are atypical third places. So kind of crack open your imagination. And then a third is what I would call a temporary third place. So probably the best example of this in our neighborhood is we have a community swimming pool. So that's not open all the time in Kansas City, but during the summer, it really becomes kind of a typical, becomes a temporary third place because all these parents are hanging out at the pool to keep an eye on their kids. And it's just a great opportunity to say, well, now which kid belongs to you and, you know, which house do you live in? But we have to be intentional. So all makes sense. Let me share with you one other story about an atypical third place because, man, this one I just think is a beautiful picture. So I was in Southern California about a year and a half ago with a Baptist group, and we just did a whole day. It was all about third places and just how to kind of engage third places. And then about 6 months ago, the guy that had me come out to do that, he said, "I want you to come back out and do the exact same thing that you did." I mean, just everything, just exactly. So I came out, went out about 6 months ago, and at the first break, there was a lady that came up to me, and she said, "Hey, I was here a year ago when you came and talked about the same thing you're talking about now." But she says, "I want to tell you a story." She said, "Not long after you were here," she said, "I went to pick up my kids at the elementary school," and she said, "I noticed a lot of the parents showed up 30 minutes, and I remember this is in Southern California, so the weather is always nice, but she said the parents were showing up 30 minutes before the kids were let out of school just to hang out." And she said, "I thought, hey, that's an atypical third place." So she said, "I made a commitment to do as much as I could to do the same thing, go 30 minutes early, kind of get to know the parents." So then she told me this long story. Really, she took like 20 minutes to tell me the story. But long story short, she met a man, a Muslim man, that had 2 sons that went to that school. And she developed a relationship with him just standing outside and found out that he owned a window washing company that, you know, he was just self-employed. And she worked at a church. Well, after getting to know him, one day she said, "Hey, what if our church, could we hire you to come clean the windows?" And she said it just blew him away. It was kind of like, "No, wait, you're a Christian woman, I'm a Muslim man, and you want to hire me to come clean your windows?" Well, he did, and then I don't know the rest of the story, but she told me on this last Easter, he showed up at an Easter service with his 2 boys. I mean, all because she saw that as an atypical third place, and she says, "I'm going to make a commitment to enter into that and build a relationship." So again, I don't know what happened since then, but just that, I thought, really, it's like, man, blessings to you. So what I like to say with third places, the first thing we have to do is identify them. So we need to think about where are the typical, the atypical, and the temporary third places in our neighborhood. And sometimes if we'll have like a whole day of training, early in the day we'll have people map their neighborhood, just take out a piece of paper, and we'll give them a sample to identify, you know, where you live, the post office, the school, where you shop, the barbershop, you know, everything. And then later in the day we'll have them pull that little map out again and then identify typical, atypical, and temporary third places. Because that's the first step, is we got to identify where they are, right? Well, then the second step, though, after we identify them, is that we need to incarnate into them. See, I like to say, because more and more people are less and less interested in the programs and activities of the church, we need to develop or create or identify new places or different places where we can engage people relationally. And I just think third place is one of the best places to do it. So we need to identify where they are, and then we need to incarnate into them. And again, this goes back to that theological foundation of incarnational presence. We need to allow the incarnation of Jesus. You know, I love, in the pre-con, we talked about this, but I love John 1:14. You know, most translations render it, you know, dwelled among us or tabernacled among us. But I love Eugene Peterson's paraphrase of that in the Message of John chapter 1, verse 14. It says, the word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood. So that's a picture of this. We need to move into these places. We need to incarnate. We need to embed. We need to stay. We need to put down roots. We need to see these places are important. We need to see that we're participating in the mission of God in these places. We need to ask, what's God doing in these places? And then we need to discern, how does he want us to engage or participate in that? So the second thing is we need to observe and listen. So part of engaging third places is we have to become great observers and we have to become great listeners. I mean, as we incarnate, we listen to what God is doing. We listen to, you know, we listen to the Spirit, but we have to listen to our surrounding. And I tell you, I'm convinced when you go into a third place with this kind of posture, there is stuff going on, you know, around. And most of the time, we either don't hear it because we don't have ears to hear, or we suppress it, or we say, well, that'd be kind of awkward. I mean, I think the Lord's asking me to lean into that. And sometimes it is awkward. I mean, there's been times I felt like the Lord was prompting me to say or do something, and I did, and was like, ooh, that was weird. I mean, I was like, I have no idea what that was about. But then I've had times, too, in coffee shops where I've heard a conversation and I've just turned around and said, look, you know, I wasn't eavesdropping, but I heard, you know, would you mind if I spoke into that? And I've had times where people say, man, turn your chair around. That'd be awesome. We'd love you to, you know. So, but that only happens if we become great observers and listeners, okay? So that's part of incarnating into those places. And then the last word there, frequency. Here's why I think third places are so important for missionally minded people. I think all of this needs to start in our neighborhood, okay? But there's a difference between engaging mission in our neighborhood and engaging mission in third places. Let me say, frame it like this. If you went to your neighbor's house every single morning and knocked on the door to say hello, what would they think of you? Obnoxious. They'd call 911. You would be referred to as a stalker, okay? But let me ask you this. What if you go into your third place every single day? What do they think of you? Yeah, you're a great customer, right?
You must not work.
Yeah, yeah, you must not work. But do you see what I mean? There's a sense of frequency that I think we can ramp up relationships. I mean, and that's a bad way to say it, ramp it up. But, you know, I just think in the neighborhood, the reality is you have to have a long kind of runway thinking, most cases, of cultivating relationships in our neighborhood. But in third places, if you're intentional, if you're a regular in that third place, the frequency as it relates to cultivating those relationships, it's just ramped up, and I think it's a helpful, beneficial thing as it relates to engaging God's mission. Okay, so here's the last thing. So I think with third places, the first thing we need to do is identify and incarnate into them. The second thing is, in some cases, we need to become a placemaker. So in other words, we need to create environments where third places can flourish. So I like to think about this on a continuum. So on one end of the continuum could be super simple, easy thing, and the other end of the continuum could be something really hard and difficult. So let's talk about the hard and difficult first. Is that maybe God is calling you to open a third place. So I've got 6 or 7 or 8 friends, some of you know them, that have church planters that instead of starting a Sunday morning worship service, they've opened a third place or a coffee shop, and they've birthed a faith community out of the relationships there. So they've been a blessing to the surrounding community. They've been a blessing to the community of people that work there, and then they've been a blessing to the community of their customers. And out of that, they've birthed a church. Got one of the best in the country is in Fort Worth. If any of you are in the Fort Worth area, it's called Brood. Joey Turner, it's fantastic. Colorado Springs, there's one called the Wild Goose Meeting House. We've got 2 in Kansas City. I mean, just really lots of places. So that's on the difficult end, that maybe God's actually calling you to open a coffee shop or a used bookstore or a thrift store or whatever it is. It can be create a third place. On the other end of the continuum, though, could be something super simple. So I'll give you a couple examples. In Kansas City, one of the churches there, the pastor several years ago, his name's Dan Sutherland. Some of you might know Dan at Westside Family Church in Kansas City. But he just went and bought one of these portable fire pits and just pulled it out on the driveway and started a fire. He just calls it a fire pit group or fireside group. And now there's nearly 40 of these in the church, you know, that every Friday or Saturday night. Now, most of them are guys. I don't know what it is about guys and fire. You know, If you can get a guy to look into a fire, he'll just open up his heart. Did you realize, you know, if we don't have to make eye contact, if we can look into the fire, we'll confess our sins. So I don't think women do that, but it's really cool that Dan, I mean, all of these groups, well, that's a very atypical kind of third place but he started that. And we did the same thing. And finally, about 2 years ago, I just built a permanent fire pit in our backyard. And I mean, when I built it, my wife and I walked out in the backyard and like, where are we going to put it? You know? So, I mean, we strategically put it in a place where there's six houses that can see it. So we've just told them, look, anytime you see a fire, it's an open sign. I mean, it's a welcome. Now, again, to go back to something I said earlier, I still think the very best thing we should do is have full-blown meals with people. But we've learned one step removed from that is to invite people over for dessert. So you can say, hey, on Friday night after dinner, you guys want to come over for dessert? It's less threatening. If they don't know you and you're crazy, they're thinking, well, I could get out of there pretty quick, you know. It's informal. More than likely, we're going to sit in the living room. You know, who doesn't like pie or cake? But the fire pit, it's even one step removed from that. I mean, it's just so easy, you know, because you're outside. It's just, there's just no threat to it. Does that make sense? So I would just be thinking, what would it look like in your context to kind of create, again, not a third place that fits Oldenburg's definition, but what would it look like for you to create an environment where a third place will flourish? When we first moved in, one of the reasons we bought the house is it has a really large side lot or yard. And there's a jillion kids where we live. And the kids just, we bought one of these big Rubbermaid, I don't know what they are, bucket things that sit out on our patio, and it's full of toys. I mean, soccer balls and jump ropes and frisbees. And the kids just love to come to our side yard because it's the biggest, like, little spot in the neighborhood. So they just, you know, they use the stuff out of the Rubbermaid bin and they play. And then we bought an old used refrigerator that we put in the garage, and we just filled it up with cheap pop and popsicles. And they play, and then they just migrate into the garage. Well, in a sense, again, Oldenburg, this doesn't fit, but in a sense, it's kind of this, you know, we've created an environment, at least for these kids, for kind of relational connections to happen. And then what happens, of course, is when it gets dark, the parents come looking for their kids, you know, so it's created other opportunities. So just think, first, identify and incarnate into ones that already exist, but then you may need to ask, well, what would it look like in my setting to actually create an environment where a third place can flourish, okay? So let me see what time it is. Okay, we got 6 minutes. So I won't read this. This is too long. But this is just a beautiful quote from Henry Nouwen that I think just summarizes all of this about engaging our first, second, and third places. And if, you know, when we're done, if you read this, if you'll just Google Henry Nouwen, Ministry of Presence, you can find this online. There's a blog that I do. It's the address is just missionalchurchnetwork.com, and I have it there on that blog. But it's just a beautiful statement from now on, just talking about, you know, I think the really important thing is just spending time with people and letting them know that I don't just like them, but I actually love them. So let me, that was a whole lot of rambling. Just kind of throw it open. And is there anything, prompts, comments, or questions? Yes, sir. So, and again, this is just, you have to apply this to your context, okay? But I actually think that's a good thing. Because too often what happens in churches that want to try to kind of make this transition, I think starting in small groups is a great place to start. But often what happens is what it means to be missional in their mind is that we need to adopt a ministry. So as a group, you know, so we meet Thursday nights, you know, in our home every Thursday night of the month. But one Thursday night of the month now, we're going to go over and serve over here. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing to serve over there. But I like to say that's a group with a mission rather than a group of missionaries. So I actually think it's a better thing that if everybody is trying to participate in what God's doing in their first, second, and third places, because the reality is everyone's not going to have that same passion. So when you say, hey, when you go over there and serve, does everybody show up? They go, well, of course not. You know, well, how many? Well, about half the people show up. Well, what's up with that? Well, it's because half the people don't really care about that. Well, think about all the little nooks and crannies that we're missing if we don't, like, activate everybody to engage. Now, you said geographically. Well, think if everybody was engaging whatever God was calling them in that little region. So I guess what I would say is to think about it more as a group of missionaries, equip and release them, engage in what God's doing. And then when they gather together weekly, have them pray for each other, share notes. Here's what I learned. And what will happen inevitably is they'll discover needs in the neighborhood that no one else in the group knew about. And they can come back and say, you know what? I didn't realize that Leslie lost her husband last week. He died of a heart attack. And, you know, as a group, can we be a blessing to her over the next 2 or 3 weeks or whatever? So again, I think it's a distinction between a group with a mission and a group of missionaries. So I think it's a good, it can be a really good thing. Yeah, I think, again, what I would say, what I said earlier, that this is best done as a communal activity. It's best done communally. I do think there are times that God's going to call us individually to engage in his mission, but we have to have a community that we can come back to, or we have to have a community that can go with us. So, I just agree with you. How to best do that, you know, I just talk about it a lot and help people. Again, in the pre-con, there's this image I like to use. It's in this book, but it's a continuum that I created to just show all the different kind of categories or ways that we live out the expression of the Christian life. And one end of the continuum is corporate worship service, and the other end of the continuum is individual missionary engagement. Well, there's a whole bunch of other things in between. Well, the point is, I say, look, this is a continuum. You want to live on a continuum. You don't want to live in a category. So you don't want to just live on this end of the continuum, but you also don't want to just live on this end of the continuum. And the reality is most of us live on this end of the continuum with corporate, that church is the corporate worship service. So we want to try to push people to living on this end. But again, if I had that continuum up, I would just say, we can't do this on our own. That we have to have a community where we can experience rest and replenishment and community. And again, like you said, in many ways, we're more effective, I think, when we do it as a group. So, yeah. So I would say, yes, amen. I would agree with that. But then the other thing I would say is if you hear, it sounds like it's all individual kind of activity. I mean, I hope that's not the case, and because it shouldn't be. We need to do this communally, I think, as much as possible. Yes, sir. And then go ahead. And then we'll come over here. Yeah, So then that's the deal with this image that I use is one of the reasons I like to talk through it. And we did this at the pre-con. It took about 30 minutes to go through this image to say, look, it's a both and. It isn't. Now, sometimes I sound really negative towards this in a continuum, but it's because we're pretty good at that. I mean, we are a gathered people, and we just, unfortunately, that's all our focus. So I find myself on this end of the continuum trying to push people towards the other end of the continuum, you know? And doing that sometimes, it's like, well, gosh, you're pretty negative about this, you know, Sunday morning gathering thing. It's like, well, no, we are a gathered people. We are a gathered and scattered people. We are a called and sent people. But I don't think we need to talk much more about the gathered stuff. I mean, or at least I don't want to. So what else? All right. Yeah, so really, most all the training we do, I end with this slide. Be patient. Seriously. Yeah, okay. But, well, I think, for one thing, you show them the ways of Jesus in the Gospels, that, the kingdom is about a little tiny mustard seed, you know? It's about leaven, and it's the subtitle of this book is Becoming a Church of the Long Run. It's not, none of this stuff happens overnight. So I like to say, usually in training we'll do, I'll say, first, you need to be patient with yourself. Because if you've been discipled by American evangelicalism, or if you've been discipled by church growth mentality for 4 or 5 decades, this stuff's not going to, you know, click. Paradigm shifting takes a long time. So we have to be patient with ourselves. I think, secondly, we have to be patient with people in our churches. You can't preach a 4-week sermon series on this and think people are going to get it. That's why, you know, I kind of started this by talking about the importance of starting with the why or paradigm shift. And I'm telling you, you have to go back to it over and over and over and over again. You get to a point where you're sick of talking about it. But if you don't, those deeply held assumptions we have about church being a place where certain things happen, that it's so deeply embedded and so strong, it's just really hard to break out of that. And then thirdly, I would say, to go to what your comment, is that we need to be patient with people outside our church. Because we live in a very post-Christian, post-Christendom context where people are so skeptical and so far from the ways of God, that it just, we have to see a really long runway relationally. And now again, there's sometimes, you know, there's a spiritual thing going on in people and some, you know, it clicks quick. But in most cases today, yeah, we have to be patient on all three fronts, I think. So, sorry, we're out of time. Any one last quick question? Okay, we're done. So thank you.